It is a pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be with my family on the occasion of April's wedding. April was the flower girl at my wedding 17 years ago today. Time marches on. It's a pleasure to see my brother, the Devo from Colorado. Pleasure to hear George Gibson sing. I never have heard him sing before, but I'll never forget it. And it's a kind of a special treat for Mike Meacham to be over there reading the scripture. Mike and I were classmates at Riverside Elementary. He's probably forgotten all this, but he used to stick out his tongue when he did his math. He may wish I would forget that, but I haven't. But at least he did his math. That was the big difference. Nice to see you again. In this world of confusion about the meaning of religion, when in the name of God people blow up other people and trap them in cults or sell Jesus like a gold chain and an insurance policy, there is some hope and some clarity in 12 little words that begin the 15th chapter of Romans. 12 simple but radical words, which if they were better known, might be banned all the way from Washington, D.C. to Sarajevo. 12 words that, if we took them seriously, would cut through much of the garbage that passes for ethical discourse in this or any society. Just 12 words. And in this very rare case, I prefer the King James Version translation. We who are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak. Now, the New Revised Standard Version, unfortunately, has translated this powerful passage this way. We who are strong ought to put up with the failings of the weak. Notice how different it sounds, to put up with something rather than to bear the infirmities of it. We put up with all sorts of things that annoy us or disturb us, right? Temper tantrums from our children, snoring from our spouse, aluminum siding salesmen that call just at dinner time to say in that innocuous voice, "Mr. Myers, how are you doing this evening?" To put up with something is to politely ignore it. But to bear the infirmities of something is to take on responsibility, to shoulder some of the burden, to move toward some of the pain in this world and ease it rather than add to it. I do not know what possessed the scholars of the New Revised Standard Version, who have produced a magnificent translation of the Bible, to pull the teeth of this passage this way. But I, for one, will always quote Romans 15:1 this way. We who are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak. Now, if you roll that around in your mouth a few times, it will, like the mouthwash Listerine, sting a little after you spit it back out. First of all, because it's so utterly simple and direct. There are two kinds of people in this world. There are the strong and the weak. Every society has such. Every church has such, and every family has such. Notice there's no obscure theology here, no need to place a call to an ivory tower expert or consult with the chair of the ethics department at the state university. There are the strong, and there are the weak. Some can cut it and swing it and make it happen, and some cannot. The strong have the breeding. They have the support systems, they have the inheritance, they have the verbal ability, they have the good looks, they have all the momentum that spells success as surely as failure is a downward spiral. The weak, on the other hand, are just as permanent a fixture in life. And notice, Paul does not do what we so often do, and that's to speculate on how the strong and the weak got that way. Are the strong just lucky? Or did they get it all by hard work, the so-called self-made man myth? are the weak that way because they don't try hard enough or think positive thoughts every morning or accept Jesus into their life? Were they dealt an unplayable hand or are they just lazy? Paul is not interested in such speculation. The world is as the world is. There are the strong and there are the weak. It's not fair, but it's there. And by the way, those words of Jesus, so often quoted out of context by laissez-faire capitalists, the poor you shall have with you always, are not a way to rationalize our guilt, but to motivate us to action. Homeless people are not an inevitable part of a free society. And notice, Paul doesn't begin with an indefinite pronoun. He says, we who are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak. Think how differently we might read the text if it began, they. They who are strong, for this is the language of uninvolved advice. It belongs to armchair generals, to tenured professors of economics, to social work bureaucrats who had their last caseload 20 years ago, to politicians who are interested in divvying up everyone's wealth but their own. Nor would this text mean anything if it began with you. You who are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak. This is the language of confrontation and demand, of political manifestos and revolutionary causes. I've been to many a national church meeting, and I'm always reminded of how foolish it is for the sheep to get together annually to pass resolutions against the wolves. It is the we that does it. It's the we that makes the passage. We who are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak. Those of us who have, for whatever reason, power, wealth, influence, talent, we ought to use it somehow for the benefit of those who do not, and not out of guilt, for too many people have just enough religion to make them feel guilty and not enough to make them feel responsible. We ought to do it out of glad obligation, because the object of life is not to luxuriate in your strength, but to use it for some good purpose. Think for a moment how obsessed our society is with the lottery. This has a certain Fond du Lac Powerball relevancy to it, I think. That was several weeks ago. We are debating whether to get the lottery in Oklahoma. And I am dead against it. And not because, as the fundamentalists are opposed to it on the philosophy that gambling is a sin. If we're going to say gambling's a sin, we'll have to close down the stock exchange and Payne Weber and all the insurance companies. It's all a big role. I'm against the lottery because nothing to me is any sadder than a society that promotes gambling against phenomenal odds and takes money out of the pockets of mostly poor people and then promotes it all with fairy tale stories of instant wealth. It is and has always been the poor who play the lottery. In George Orwell's classic novel, 1984, it is the proles, or those stupid masses of that controlled society, that were, quote, allowed to play the lottery. Seemingly harmless pastime, it keeps them sort of placated, keeps them occupied, justifies their meaningless existence through a false and fantastic hope. But here's the message, and think about it this way, and I know, being an unrepentant liberal, my being against the lottery strikes you as a little strange, but you never know what I'm going to say. Think about the message. Hard work and education and ingenuity are not the way out. It's luck. Luck will get you out. Only a morally bankrupt society could allow the sponsorship of such a cruel hoax, so detrimental to all the virtues we say we believe in, and to use it to fund education, which is supposed to be its saving grace, when you think about it, is a scathing indictment that we would promise to compensate for our inability to properly fund the most important single collective endeavor in our society, public education, with a game played mostly by the poor. It's awful. Paul does not say, we who are strong ought to devise any means possible to add to our strength. to take yet more from the poor who somehow deserve their fate. It says we who are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak, take them on, ease them, eliminate them where we can. This is the ultimate ethical test, even as compassion is the ultimate religious disposition. Now, there's a lot of guilt, I think, being carried around these days by the strong. You can hear it in the coffee shop, at the country club, and in the, what I consider, incessant banalities of the man who embarrasses my beloved home state of Kansas, Robert Dole. You can see it in the ferocity of attacks against a new administration that has the very unenviable job of trying to clean up after the long party. It is never the partygoers that feel responsibility to clean up the mess. It's always someone else's job, the cleaning crew, who weren't invited to the party to begin with. I saw something amazing in my home state of Oklahoma. We have a newspaper edited by a charter member of the John Birch Society, Eddie Gaylord. It is the furthest right paper on earth. There is no further right paper than the Daily Oklahoman. Makes Kansas look liberal. And there was a commercial in it, an advertisement for something called Slick Willy Golf Balls. You've probably seen them. They're very clever. It says on them, a good lie guaranteed. Now, I think it's pretty clever, and I appreciate a good political joke as much as the next guy. I've suffered some of Clinton's early mistakes. I disagree with him very much on the bombing of Iraq, but what difference does it make? My point is, the Daily Oklahoman would never have carried an ad like that for George Bush. Let's say someone had decided to elect him international spokesman of wimpy hamburgers. They would not have carried this advertisement. It would have been disrespectful. And whoever called Bush a wimp, which is disrespectful, may very well have contributed to the former president's obsession with foreign affairs and with proving repeatedly that we are strong, that he's strong. That's not the kind of strength Paul's talking about. That's not the kind of strength Jesus is talking about. The ethical treatment of the weak is the central theme of the gospel. I mean, we're not wandering off down some sparse, poorly marked trail here. We're smack dab in the middle of a 6-lane expressway. We're not wandering off in search of what makes a saint. We're cutting a swath home toward what makes a Christian. Even the Ten Commandments can be thought of as God's way of trying to protect the weak. I had never thought of it that way, but think of it. Listen, just because you're young, don't neglect your parents. Honor them. Just because you're strong and could do it, don't kill. Just because you're good with words, don't hurt another with a lie. Just because you're crafty and could get away with it, don't steal. Just because you're attractive, don't move in on your neighbor's spouse. Don't you see? This is God's way of putting the great arms of heaven around the weak ones in this world. And with whom was Jesus most concerned? It's a litany of the weak, the poor, the widowed, the orphan, the alien. And always, when Israel's religion was being examined, the questions were never theological, they were always ethical. How is it? How is it in the land with the widow, the stranger, the forgotten, the dispossessed? That's precisely the problem with American religion. Too many of our questions are theological, not enough of them are ethical. Beginning with the first, how well are we bearing the infirmities of the weak? Let's translate this to finish up into some contemporary images. This is how I like to make the Bible real. How do you bear the infirmities of the weak? It is how the postal clerk deals with the immigrant who doesn't understand the difference between a piece of certified mail and a registered letter. It's how a daughter relates to an aging mother who more and more drifts into periods of irreversible senility. It's how a minister conducts herself before the drop-in vagrant who wants to tell a story and press a need. It's how the full professor deals with a stupid question in History 101. We could begin, I I think I have a good way for us all to start. You could say to the young black man who sacks your groceries, "Thank you, sir." And why does Paul say we ought to take care of them? Is it for purely practical reasons, to provide what is fashionably called a social safety net? Like if we don't, they could very well get together, buy some weapons, and make life very difficult for the rest of us. Well, every spring in Washington, a bill is passed to provide emergency funds to keep cities cool in the summer. But that's not where the passage gets its leverage. We could argue that we had better take care of the weak today because we could be weak ourselves someday, and that is profoundly true. But the biblical ethic is deeper than this. It's one of consequence. We love because he first loved us. That is, while we were yet abjectly weak, God bore our infirmities. For as Ernest Campbell said on the cross, Christ was made weak on behalf of the weakness in all of us. And his commandment to follow me is inseparable from the notion that having been lifted up out of our weakness, we in turn are supposed to lift others out of theirs. Do you remember the first sermon that Jesus ever preached in his home synagogue? He opened the scroll to Isaiah and he read, "I've come to give sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." And in the most stirring ethical imperative in Scripture, he quite literally transposes himself into the weak, becomes every weak person in the world when he says, "For in so much as you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me." Now, this is not easy. When you get right down to it, the weak and the disfranchised are very difficult to love. They are very difficult to love. First of all, because we feel condescending, and then because they feel condescended to. And in this world of, you know, plastic surgery and tummy tucks and liposuction, they're often very unkempt and lacking in social graces. They sometimes take our money and they spend it on booze. Or they tell their friends where they got the money and they line up at the door. Or they sell our name to every organization saving everything on earth with our money. I gave $50 to a man in Detroit once who said he was in desperate circumstance. He bought $50 worth of meat and set up a little meat market outside the store and resold the meat that I had given him the money to buy. Pretty ingenious, but you can get cynical. However messy compassion may be, and there was a reason that Jesus said we must be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves, we're never released from our obligations to the weak among us. In fact, our best efforts to make them strong are what make us truly strong. My church in Oklahoma City is at its best when we are delivering mobile meals or visiting a person with AIDS or tutoring some ghetto children in math and reading at the predominantly black church with which we've entered a covenant. We're at our worst when we argue over decor or definitions of patriotism or the latest injury to our delicate psyches. We're at our worst when we gossip. We're at our best when we serve. And the good news is that my beloved church in Oklahoma City does serve more and more. My fondest memory of that congregation is now several years old. A homeless person, young man, hungry, spaced out, in need of some food and human contact, wandered into one of our church dinners. We are a city church. We're on a busy highway. This happens. And I watched my congregation make a place for him. First in the line where they gave him cuts, and then at the table where he was a stranger to all of us. He went through the line three times, consumed three enormous plates of food, and then he stayed after for Bible study, which I'm sure he cared nothing about but didn't feel it was right to eat and run. They asked him for his name, and he gave it, and then I heard them using it. And that's the sweetest sound I've ever heard. Now, he will probably never join our church, but he has helped to make it a church. And paradoxically, in his weakness, he made us strong. We who are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak. I need to think about this. You need to think about this. 12 little words. The Bible sometimes bothers me because I wish it were not so clear.